Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
I didn't really intend to play this, but winds up it is appropriate. So I'm reading. Yesterday I was talking about the history of the Supreme Court and how nominees are nominated and all of that, right? So, pretty interesting stuff. And the article that I'll recommend to you is, it's kind of a doinkish. Now, I won't say doinkish. Well, kind of. It's an article in National Review, right? So, obviously conservative. By a guy named Dan McLaughlin. So, what McLaughlin does in painstaking detail is lay out the history of nominations to the Supreme Court, right, in an article that's about 10 pages long. And you go through the history of the country in the article, and we'll go through some of it. And then you look at this narrative that is currently in the country. And I mean, again, it becomes head shaking that my ideological whatever gives me the right to, I don't know, do whatever I want to do. Because I believe something, I now don't have to fulfill my function in government if I'm a member of the media. I mean, we do a job in a democracy, so somebody's decided that no. You got to get over that, man. You're an activist now. You're not a, you know, you got to get over that whole journalism school bullshit, man. We got money to make. We got business to do. Okay, we have an agenda. And so you watch the discussion in the country and you watch the things people say, or you listen to the things people say, and it's just disturbing, because you can't have a discussion if you can't even agree on a place to begin the discussion. And you listen to the the bullshit people say, and you're like, do they know how to read? Do they do any research? Or is it just, this is how I feel, and so therefore I am? And I don't know. I just find it, you know, I just find it disturbing. So let me just go through some of the article with you here, and the disturbing part is, then how do we ever have a civil discussion about anything in this country if, you know, we can't do these things? And then Grant Newsham will join us today in the second hour. Grant kind of, I'll let Grant explain it, but he talks about our relations around the Pacific. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. I hadn't intended to have him on, but it's interesting. Anyway, so the title of this article, and I alluded to this article yesterday, it's called History is on the Side of Republicans Filling a Supreme Court Vacancy in 2020. Now, this was written in the first week of August, so it hasn't been written since Justice Ginsburg passed away. But there were certainly rumors that her repeated hospitalization might require her to, you know, to leave the court. So anyway, this is Dan McLaughlin. If the Supreme Court vacancy opens up between now and the end of the year, Republicans should fill it, given the vital importance of the court to rank-and-file Republican voters. There is no such law. There is no such norm. All of those in terms of gapping it, right, and allowing it when you control the White House and the Senate. There is no such law. There is no such norm. All of those are on the side of filling the vacancy. Choosing not to fill a vacancy would be a historically unprecedented act of unilateral disarmament. It has never happened once in all of American history. Think about that. So when you hear that a party that controls the Senate and the White House has never done what is being suggested in American history, think about the narrative that you hear, you know, in the nation's media. Not once in American history. Now that breaks squelch for anybody. There is no chance the Democrats in the same position would ever reciprocate as their own history indicates. So, and then I'm going to skip through the article, right? He goes on, history is on the side of the Republicans filling the seat. Historically, throughout American history, when their party controls the Senate, presidents get to fill Supreme Court vacancies at any time. Even in a presidential election year, even in a lame duck session, after the election, even after defeat. Think about that. So I've been defeated as running for my second term. I'm a lame duck, and I nominate and fill a Supreme Court vacancy. How about that? Both of those precedents are settled, okay? Settled is an important term, right? By experience as old as the Republic. Republicans should take note, Republicans should not create a brand new precedent to deviate from them. There are two types of rules in Washington: laws that allocate power and norms that reflect how power has traditionally, historically been used. Laws that allocate power are paramount and particularly dangerous to violate. But there is no law at issue here. A president can always make a nomination for a Supreme Court vacancy, no matter how late in his or her term or how many times he or she has been turned down. The only thing in his or her way is the Senate. 29 times in American history, there has been an open Supreme Court vacancy in a presidential election year or a lame duck session before the next presidential inauguration. The president made a nomination in all 29 cases. And then he goes into, you know, some those the people that got nominated and all that kind of stuff. Like I said, it's a pretty detailed article. So today, Donald Trump has the raw power to make a Supreme Court nomination all the way till the end of his term. Senate Republicans have the raw power to confirm one, at least until a new Senate is seated on January 3rd. And so long as there's at least 50 Republican senators on that date until Trump leaves office, whether they should use this power, however, is a matter of norms and politics. Norms are crucially important. If parties cannot trust that the other side will abide by established norms of conduct, politics devolve rapidly into a blood sport that quickly loses the capacity to resolve disagreements peaceably within the system. Those norms are derived from traditions and history. So let's look at history. Senate precedents. In 2016, Barack Obama used his raw power to nominate Merrick Garland to replace Anton Scalia in March of the last year of Obama's term, with the Trump-Clinton election underway. The Republican majority in the Senate used its raw power to refuse to seat the nominee. Having reached that decision, the Republican majority did not even hold a hearing for an outcome that was predetermined. In looking back at that exercise of Senate power in 2017, I concluded that it was supported by historical precedent. And then he's got this table, right? And the table has the nominee, who was the president, what was the outcome, blah, 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 blah. In short, there have been 10 vacancies resulting in presidential election year or post-election nomination when the president and the Senate were from the opposite parties. In 6 of the 10 cases, a nomination was made before an election day. Only one of those, Chief Justice Melville Fuller, nomination by Grover Cleveland in 1888, was confirmed before the election. 4 nominations were made in lame duck session after the election. 3 of those were left open for the winner of the election. Other than the unusual Fuller nomination, which was made because the court was facing a crisis of backlogs on its docket, 3 of the other 9 were filled after Election Day in ways that rewarded the winner of the presidential contest. And then he goes into that. The norm in these cases strongly favors holding the seat open for the conflict between the two branches to be resolved by the presidential election. So, what does history say about the situation where a president is in his last year of office and his party controls the Senate? Once again, historical practice and tradition provides a clear and definitive answer. In the absence of divided government, election year nominees get confirmed. Let me read that again. Once again, historical practice and tradition provides a clear and definitive answer. In the absence of divided government, which we do not have now, election year nominees get confirmed. 19 times between 1796 and 1968, presidents have sought to fill a Supreme Court vacancy in a presidential election year while their party controlled the Senate. 10 of those nominations came before the election. Nine of the 10 were successful. The only failure was the bipartisan filibuster for the ethically challenged Abe Fortas as Chief Justice in 1968. And then he goes on to talk about different votes and different people. 9 times presidents have made nominations after the election in a lame duck session. How about that? Listen to this. And this is the cherry on top of it. When your party controls the White House and the Senate, right? So 9 times presidents have made nominations after the election in a lame duck session. 3 of the presidents who filled lame duck vacancies, John Adams, Martin Van Buren, and Benjamin Harrison, had lost the election. So, talk about driving it over the cliff, right? They're making Supreme Court nominations post-election when they've lost. Yeah. So anyway, the bottom line, if a president and the Senate agree on a Supreme Court nominee, timing has never stopped them. By tradition, only when the voters have elected a president and a Senate majority from different parties has the fact of a looming election mattered. When there is no dispute between the branches, there is no need to ask the voters to resolve one. Then he talks about political games and previous statements and kind of goes into that. And so then he goes into what Mitch McConnell did in 2016. This is McConnell's statement on the floor. Republicans hold the gavels in the Senate. This is quoting Mitch McConnell. And a term-limited Democrat in the twilight of his presidency occupies the White House. Justice Scalia's death marks the first time a sitting Supreme Court justice has passed away in a presidential year in 100 years. And it's the first time a sitting Supreme Court justice passed away in a presidential election year during divided government since 1888. And so the decision not to consider it was consistent with historical precedent that had been, you know, set down throughout the history of our republic. And then he ends, here's the last part of it, the nuclear option. The final concern expressed by those hesitant to confirm a new justice in an election year or a lame duck session is that Democrats would use this as an excuse for ideological court packing that would destroy the court's legitimacy and ultimately the rule of written law in America. This is not a chimerical concern. Chimerical. Yeah, hold on. It's an adjective of a myth. It's of a mythical animal formed from parts of various animals. The design is based on a chimeric creature with the body of a turtle and the head of a dragon. So I don't use it often, maybe never, but you can get the gist of the word, right? Unpleasant. But the Democrats' behavior is not something Republicans can control in any event, and allowing them to threaten the destruction of the Constitutional Republic in order to cow Republicans out of following tradition would set a bad precedent in and of itself. Democrats may pack the court anyway. A noisy faction of them, including failed presidential contenders on Biden's vice presidential list, have already committed to court packing. Kapur, I don't know who that is, but was cited previously somewhere in the article, reports that the Democratic National Committee is poised to add language to the party's 2020 platform endorsing a structural court reform to increase transparency and accountability, and accusing Republicans of having packed our federal courts with unqualified partisan judges. Efforts to justify court packing and blur the term's meaning that predate any move to replace Ginsburg. Or they may not. Biden is on record opposing court packing. For whatever influence he may have after the election, Bernie Sanders has opposed it too. They and other experienced Democrats recognize the potentially explosive political consequences of openly making war on the independence of the judiciary, given how badly it played even for Franklin Roosevelt at the pinnacle of his popularity. Having history on their side would make the Republican defense against court packing a formidable base from which to launch a major last-ditch resistance on behalf of the Constitution entering the 2022 midterms. The post-Kavanaugh rally of Republican Senate candidates in 2018, while their colleagues in the House were sinking, testifies dramatically to the galvanizing effect the fights over the court have had on Republican voters. It's kind of an interesting observation, right? that the quote-unquote Kavanaugh effect on the Senate elections. He ends like this. Few things contributed more to the Republican Party's institutional inability to resist a hostile takeover by Donald Trump in 2016 than a widespread sense that the party would not even fight for its own stated principles if it could find any excuse not to. Nothing is more central to Republican stated principles than control of the Supreme Court by justices who believe in the written Constitution. No practical application of those principles is more iconic and visceral in its importance than social conservatives' long labors against Roe v. Wade, a battle which John Roberts seems to require more reinforcement before he will act. Republicans should not discard the rule of law or traditional norms to achieve their ends, but a Ginsburg vacancy, if one happens, now remember, this was written in early August, would require Republicans not only to act within the law and in accordance with tradition, and woe to the future if they should shrink from that. So just kind of a deeper dive into what we talked about yesterday. That this has happened 29 times in the nation's history, and the president made a nomination in all 29 cases. In 19 cases where the same party controlled the White House and the Senate, there was a confirmation in all cases except for one. Or two, and both had to deal with the qualifications of the candidate, that the Senate didn't like them. And then in 10, where the White House and the Senate were owned by separate parties, they were not advanced. And again, as I said yesterday, it's just if you watch the commentary on television, it's stunning. None of this has anything to do with anything. It is people with an agenda, and the history of this nation doesn't matter. And I think that what he says in the article is that if you think that Democrats, if they were in a similar position, would not nominate somebody and confirm them and cite historical precedent, you're dumber than a bag of hammers. Yeah, straight up. So, but again, what's astounding to me is this absence of the truth from our national discourse. And, God help us in the future. Because, what matters is your Twitter account. What matters is not the history of our nation, the way we do business. What matters is what influencers are saying today. And I don't know. I'm not real optimistic on the future of the country. And it pains me to say that, but I don't believe that the officers in Minneapolis are going to be convicted. And what happens then? What happens when the shock of a jury reaching a verdict where they say not guilty? What happens when that echoes through the country, in a country that has been set up to believe that those cops acted as racists, blah, 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 blah? What happens if that's not the truth? Because that's the narrative in the country. And the vast majority of the media do not push back against that. So it's this fight over, what social media tells me, because that's the way I get my news, and what is in fact true. And I don't see what turns that around. When you look at, we've had cities burning, and have you seen, the two most prominent Democratic leaders in our nation, have you seen them stand up and say, this has to stop? Have you heard that as the first statement okay, regardless of what I believe about the outcome of this, this has to stop. Have you heard that from? And the answer is no. The answer is no. And so it's just more of this, this inability to compromise that has infected our government. And I don't know what turns it around. I'm not, and I'm not hopeful about it either. I mean, again, I go back to, but for some idiot in Alexandria that tried to get through the wrong gate at a baseball field, this discord would have probably led to the deaths of about 30 Republican congressmen. As it was, Steve Scalia was shot right before that guy was killed. And there was, you know, great concern and, you know, things have to change. Well, we digested that and moved right on with business as usual. And so at some point, something like that's going to happen. Something really bad's going to happen. Because in this country, I remember having Senator Byron Dorgan on from the state of New of North Dakota. And, you know, one of the things he told me was, you know, you can't compromise anymore. If you compromise, as he's a Democrat. I mean, the North Dakota senators are were Democrats. They were conservative Democrats, right? Pro-defense, pro-business Democrats. So anyway, he said the only thing you do when if you compromise with the Republicans on a bill is you ensure that you will have a contested, you know, primary as an incumbent. He said, that's just the truth. You can't compromise. And the lubricant of democracy is compromise. And so not sure how where all of this goes. You know, you've seen it in the defunding of the police, screaming and yelling about defund the police, defund the police, defund the police. And then they go ahead and do it without so much as even a task force, you know, in days, you know, identify what they want to cut and then cut it. And now there's just recently, I want to say last week or the week before, I saw articles where in a city council meeting in Minneapolis, city council members were asking the chief of police, what's going on with the spike in violence in the city? Why is there more violent crime? and so it goes. So I don't color me concerned, and I don't see it turning around. And if and when that those verdicts come back that those cops are not guilty of the charges they've been charged with, second degree murder, I think, in the case of Derek Chauvin. You saw the reactions of mayors around the country. I mean, they were scared. They were scared to protect the property of the city, to call in the National Guard, to stop the looting that was going on. And none of that looting was for anything, but it had nothing to do with the protest. Just people being opportunist. And they wouldn't even stop it. So I don't know. So you have a leadership crisis and a media crisis, all of it catering to the path of least resistance. And in this case, if even the most basic reading of history, even the most basic reading of history, you would come to the conclusion like, yeah, that's how we do it. The party in power, when they have this opportunity, they don't say, yeah, you're right. We just won't do it. We'll hold off on it. They don't do that. So anyway, yeah, color me concerned. Grant Newsham's going to join us here at the top of the hour. I'm in the decorating phase of Studio 2. Yeah. So I'm working with my artistic, my creative consultant, my daughter, Catherine. And took a bunch of stuff off my walls and what should be on the walls of Studio 2. And so working on that. And then I'm going to do post-traumatic winning in Zoom fashion with the University of Arizona and our ROTC people here in a couple weeks. couple weeks. Yeah, a couple weeks. And so fired up about that. That may be the first live use of the studio. And then I'll do the 5-hour version of Post Traumatic Winning again, filming myself, and then I'll integrate that into what I've already built. Yep, fired up about that. And then I've got to finish writing the book. So a fair amount of work to do here in the future, but exciting stuff and then the YouTube channel will come online. Yep. So so exciting stuff. So in looking at the studio, right, what should be in the background? Well, there's got to be some I Love Me stuff on the wall, right? One would think. And then there's got to be the Post-Traumatic Winning logo. That's got to be there. And then there should be the 3 goals and 10 commandments. That's got to be in there, right? I would think. And then I think people that are significant to what's gone on. So, I mean, General Furness got to be in there, right? Libby's got to be in there. She's got to be on the wall. So I'm working on the, which is really the fun part, is the creative part. So working on that and yeah, like I said, it's interesting and fun. And so the YouTube channel will stand up, I don't know, in the next month or so. And then also working on trying to turn it into a play. How about that? That can be performed by young people in community theater groups around the country. And so they can talk, they can bring this message of hope to their peers in that kind of a form, which I think is really cool. And so exciting stuff relative to Post-Traumatic Winning. So anyway, but I would tell you, I mean, I look at the stuff that goes on in our country today, and it's not a rational discussion. It's an irrational discussion that is, in my opinion, extremely disturbing. And I don't see anything that would that gives me confidence that it's going to turn around anytime soon. Yeah. So, good morning to you. Grant's going to come on. Grant wrote a piece in Asia Times that says this: did Trump really spoil America's Asia alliances? And then the subheadline is, in reality, Trump has moved the U.S. closer to India, Japan, Australia, and Southeast Asian allies than his predecessors ever did, by Grant Newsham. So anyway, so we'll talk to Grant about that today. And that was, you know, again, and I've even said, look, I think that the president needs to do more in the Pacific to enable those alliances. But the events coming out of the Philippines, the pardon of a Marine, you know, that's not something the president of the Philippines, why would he do that? Why would he do that, Mr. Duterte? Good question, right? And so what you see is, you know, and then the news of Palau offering the United States, you know, basing rights, you know, when the United States is competing with China, you know, across the Pacific. And so you look at a map of that and you look at the United States across the Pacific and you're like, wow, the United States is not in a bad position in the Pacific in this competition. And China, you know, as every day goes by, shows itself for what it is. And is that a good dance partner for you as a nation, if you care about things like that? If you just care about maybe lining your own pockets, maybe China's maybe a better thing, but maybe not. You could probably line your pockets pretty well with American interests too. So we'll talk to Grant about that today, and then the Mensa brothers will join us tomorrow. Yeah, and then Greg Lotus hopefully on Friday. I got to get my daughter-in-law back on and talk about food again one of these days. So we'll get Susie back on and do that. And I've got to get an update on the chef too. So anyway, we will open the program. We will get a we'll check news headlines. Let me read you an email, Mac. It's pretty interesting listening to you go through the history of Supreme Court nominations. I hadn't seen that piece. And I sat here and listened, shaking my head. One would think that if you're going to participate in this discussion, those might be the first words out of your mouth, unless you oppose this, in which case you would never, ever even go near it. Maybe that's why on most news networks you never hear that history, because it simply doesn't play into the hands of what people want today. And more than any time in my life, I feel today that people are willing to say, screw the history of this nation, we want it done this way. Just a thought. There's that certainly in the air. I would absolutely agree with you. We don't care. What is that? I know there's somebody, make me smart about this, but remember there's something written about, I don't know if it was about the Holocaust. We had them. We had them sew gold stars on their jackets, and I did nothing. We destroyed their businesses, and I remained silent. We moved them to one part of the city, and I was afraid. When they left, we took over their living quarters, their shops, and even the ghetto that they were housed in. And I said nothing. And then I think it goes on and it says something like, and then they came for me. And so to me, when you say, yeah, we don't care about any of this stuff. We don't care about the nation's history. We don't care about the way we do business. We don't care, about how the nation has functioned. When you throw all that away, at some point it's going to come for you. And it will. And it absolutely will. And then it will eat you. So anyway, good morning on a Wednesday morning. The United States Marine Corps band makes this morning official. Good morning. We'll be right back. excuse me. Let me read another email. Mac, are you going to watch the debates? I'm not really interested in getting informed relative to who I'm going to vote for because I don't think I have an option being a conservative. I would never vote for Joe Biden. But the sheer spectacle of watching Biden off a teleprompter and on his own 2 feet is making me laugh. I can't wait. Trump does a lot of stupid stuff, but he's pretty good on his feet. Biden, not so much. I'm kind of interested in how that one turns out. Will you watch? That's like, you know, watching, you know, waiting for the you know, somebody to get hurt. I don't know. To me, that stuff's depressing. I stay away. Once I get done here in the studio in the morning, I turn that thing off. I read selective stuff throughout the course of the day. To me, the Wall Street Journal, fantastic. I mean, and again, not just their opinion pieces, but I think their news is fantastic. And you can't say that about very many news organizations in this country anymore. The news is riddled with opinion. And so I don't know if I'll watch it. Maybe I'll just catch the recap and the highlights and skip watching the painful blow by blow by blow. Think about this. Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that's the best this nation has to offer. I mean, God help us, right? So, I don't know. In my somberness as a individual, this is dedicated to me. Hopefully me and people like me, somebody gives us some hope, some reason for hope. Somebody gives us some example of leadership in this country that's selfless, that's truth-based, that's not afraid, that stands up for what's right, and sets an example in this country of compassionate, principled leadership that includes everybody. And, you know, the de Blasios, the Cuomos, the mayor in Seattle, the clown in Minneapolis, who's going to get a second shot at this. And what's that fool going to do this time? I mean, he was crying last time this happened. That's probably not the human being we need in charge. Get that guy to quit. Get an adult in there. Right? The mayor of Portland, that idiot. So, here's in the hope that we begin to find leaders that understand leadership and that extend a hand to everyone, you know, require respect, and that this discussion include everybody and be rooted in the truth. Not simply, you know, what you believe or what your Twitter account says, because that's not always the truth. I hate to break that to everybody. So this is dedicated to me and that proposition. I liked saying that proposition because Lincoln says it in the Gettysburg Address. And the proposition, no, that all men are created equal? Is that the Constitution? I don't know. It's one of those great speeches.
Our flag comes first. You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Officially in the Gettysburg Address, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. I knew dedicated to the proposition was in there someplace. Or at least I was pretty sure. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those here who gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far beyond our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus so far nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they here gave their last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that those dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Now, that concludes my remarks. I know it's brief. I hope you enjoyed them. I'm out. Abe Lincoln. yeah, like he spoke for like, I think, less than 3 minutes total. Gettysburg Address. One of the greatest speeches of all time. Especially the part where he talks about we cannot further consecrate this ground beyond which they already have. To me, that's, I don't know, for whatever reason, I find that, I don't know, pretty pointed. We'll check the weather now. Currently in Quantico, sunny in 72. Down the coast at Camp Lejeune, mostly sunny 71. 29 Palms, sunny in 80. Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton, it is mostly sunny and 64 degrees, cooling off here in California. At Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark cloudy in 72. Okinawa, dark cloudy in 78. Down under, on the northern coast of Australia, in Darwin, it is dark cloudy, 81, so pretty warm in Australia. And as we continue way further to the northwest, in Oslo, in Norway, It is cloudy and 59 degrees at the home of All Marine Radio right now. It's sunny and 66. Looking for a high today of 79 degrees, 78 tomorrow, 76 on Friday, 77 on Saturday, and 80 on Sunday. That is what I'm talking about. Okay? That is what I'm talking about. Damn it. I have no time to do the news, man. Another email. I share your concern. Out. Well said. That was funny. That was funny. Here's one more. A little bit depressing today, Mac. For the same reason, I stopped watching the news a couple months ago. I don't care what side you're on. The back and forth is exhausting. And during the COVID thing, before there were any sports on, I found it absolutely depressing. So I just stopped watching it. I took your advice. I downloaded that Associated Press app. And I even found a way to get the Wall Street Journal for pretty cheap. That was good advice. Thank you. I don't watch TV news anymore. I just find it hysterical and many times stupid. Interesting. All right, let me do a little bit of news headlines. Stars and Stripes. House passes bill to clear the path for Army Sergeant First Class Alwyn Cash to receive a posthumous Medal of Honor. Well, why would the House have to pass a bill? He earned the Silver Star for his actions in Iraq in 2005. The bill is necessary to waive a federal law that generally requires a Medal of Honor to be awarded within 5 years of the actions that gave rise to the award. Got it. Normally those things pass by what's called unanimous consent. Sergeant First Class Cash was 35 years old when he died on November 5th of 2005 at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio from injuries sustained on October 17th while deployed with the 3rd Infantry Division in Samarra in Iraq. He was riding in a Bradley fighting vehicle that rolled over a roadside bomb, exploded. The vehicle was quickly engulfed in flames. He was relatively unharmed but drenched in fuel, according to his Silver Star citation. He then made numerous trips to and from the burning vehicle to extract his fellow soldiers, even while his own clothing continued to catch fire. He suffered second and third degree burns to more than 72% of his body. His actions saved the lives of 6 soldiers. So his Silver Star being upgraded to a Medal of Honor. So that in the news. Coast Guard cutter docks in Yokosuka for repairs days after a shipboard fire. So that is in the news. The DOD is opening schools in South Korea as military COVID cases subside in Korea. Navy school bases in Bahrain have reopened classrooms. The House has approved a bill ordering the VA to change gender-exclusive motto. So, we have that going on. So, in the Wall Street Journal, a couple headlines from them. Top headline, Justice Ginsburg commemorations begin in Washington, and there's pictures of Justice Ginsburg's casket being taken into the Supreme Court. So she will lie in state there, or I don't know if that's the appropriate term, but her body, her casket will be there before she is buried with her husband in Arlington Cemetery. Johnson & Johnson begins final stages of testing of a COVID-19 vaccine. Said it could learn pivotal results from its coronavirus vaccine trial by early next year, which, if positive, could lead to government authorization for the shot for emergency use soon afterwards. And this is a single shot that would evidently inoculate you against COVID. Sad news, Gail Sayers passed away at the age of 77. Now, Gail Sayers has been out of the public eye for a long, long time. I didn't know he was still alive, to be honest with you. I didn't know that he was still alive. So that in the news today. On USNI news. Marine sailors to join the National Guard to fight California wildfires. We talked about this last week. Marines from Camp Pendleton, from 1st MLG, were headed up. Now, most of the time what happens is they do support missions to free other people to go fight fires. And then they work on backfires, fires that have already been put out. And then just they make sure that, you know, these areas don't flare back up, things like that. So Marines from Camp Pendleton doing that. Active duty Marines, which is kind of interesting. The top story in Marine Corps Times today. California Marine unit set to receive first amphibious combat vehicle. The first batch of 18 amphibious combat vehicles will be delivered to Marines aboard 29 Palms, California next month, according to the Marine Corps. The 18-wheeled amphibious combat vehicle is set to replace the tracked amphibious assault vehicle that the Marine Corps has been using since Vietnam. Now, here's the ironic part. There's not a drop of water anywhere near 29 Palms, so why is it being fielded there? Right? The first batch will go to a platoon of Marines with 3rd Assault Amphibian Battalion, 1st Marine Division. The next lot to hit the fleet is expected sometime in January or February, followed by a string of vehicles hitting the fleet every 2 to 3 months. Why? I don't know. I don't know why they went to the desert first. I don't know why I think that's funny. Another story. Marine veteran Illinois State Trooper indicted on $3 million Cherry Point equipment theft ring. Nice. Next headline, 3 Marine families file lawsuit for slumlord-level privatized housing at Camp Lejeune. How about that? Yeah, some of the stories that, you know, my trips back there, people are the way they were living, having to move, and all that happened after those, the hurricanes. Amazing. Amazing. And this whole experiment in privatized housing, I don't know at the end of the day if it's done anything positive. I mean, certainly, you know, the Congress will tell you that they believe that it's better. But I will tell you, when you look at some of the things that have gone on, it hasn't been a good thing. And Congress has stopped taking a look at it, and I don't know. The assumption was we'll give it to these companies and it'll all be good, and it hasn't been. Next story, 2 Lance Corporals accused in a drug case that led to Camp Pendleton Marines overdose. Drugs in the military is continuing to be a huge problem. the drugs now, LSD. Yeah. All over the Marine Corps. All over the Marine Corps. I mean, all over all the services, to be honest with you, if you talk to people in those services. One more story. Marine Corps to launch 3-year Marine Littoral Regiment experiment using Hawaii Marines. So this is part of General Berger's remaking of the Marine Corps and the whole littoral combat thing, where Marines become the security element for rockets on light amphibious ships. So good luck on that. Good luck on that deal. The top 5 stories in early bird, then we'll take a break and we'll get Grant on. Number 1, Pentagon used taxpayer money meant for masks and swabs to make jet engine parts and body armor. Number 2, that's from the Washington Post. Number 2, Air Force moves to cancel contracts for training on white privilege. The Air Force is taking the first steps towards canceling any contracts for diversity and unconscious bias training that includes segments on white privilege and other controversial subjects as called for by the White House. Next story. For Alwin Cash's family, another step towards an overdue honor. And we spoke about his the House measure that was passed that paves the way for his Medal of Honor. Number 4, Pentagon has started prudent planning for a full Afghanistan withdrawal by next May. Number 5, U.S. and United Arab Emirates eyed December goal to agree on an F-35 deal. So let us look at your news today. Grant Newsham will join us here as we continue on a Wednesday. And we're going to talk about something Grant wrote here. And so I saw it. And I said, hey, do you want to come on and talk about this? And he said, I would like to do that. And the headline is this: did Trump really spoil America's Asia alliances? Now, the president, when he came into office, he said the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a bad deal. And so and my criticism, and Grant and I have talked about this, was, okay, so why haven't we seen bilateral agreements, you know, with our with Asia? Because we are turning our attention in that direction. And the number one weapon the United States has are not nuclear weapons, it's economy. We can open the doors to great things. And so Grant wrote this piece, and we'll talk about the condition of American alliances in the Pacific. He said, I started to write this seriously, and it turned into a piece with a lot of humor in it. So we'll talk about that. Don't touch that dial. Grant Newsham coming up next on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.